Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Sandy Bob Show. This is a show where we share some very interesting things that you don't find from normally other sources. And we always start the show, or we're going to start doing the show by reminding everybody to do the new UUU. And for those new to the show, the new UUU is a song that can be sung, and we recommend that you sing it for about 20 minutes in the morning when you get up and 20 minutes at night before you go to sleep at night. And if you're rushed or new to it, you could actually do it for 15 minutes. But the reason why we do it for 15 or 20 minutes is every day is to show intent to the real guides. Now, the real guides are from the All Is, and they have come to planet Earth to assist anybody that wants to find out what the truth is and get out of this hellish Earth living that they're living in and go back to where paradise is on the real side, and they can show the way, and that's what we're all about, is we're sharing information. We're trying to wake people up that things are not right on this planet. So the way you do the new UUU is you sing it something like new UUU, and you sing it rather than chant it, and you just sing that, and you can do it out loud, or you can do it to yourself silently internally, and that's all you have to do, and ask the real guides to show you what is real, and they will come to you in your dream state and start opening up vistas that you never even knew existed. Well, today I would like to start talking about the photon belt, and I know that Dwayne the Great Writer has talked about the photon belt. And I first became aware of the photon belt around 1990. I have a friend that worked for the government, was a CIA agent, and was privy to a lot of the hidden information that wasn't really made to the public. And she told me that we were about to encounter the photon belt, and it would make drastic changes on the planet Earth. It would raise people's level of consciousness way beyond anything that was ever seen in recent history, anyway, on the planet. And it would be a real time of awakening. And that was my first introduction to the photon belt. Well, Dwayne the Great Writer has talked about that we're about to encounter the photon belt, and he says that it'll be very interesting also. Well, another thing, back in 1990, not only were the government officials saying that the photon belt would raise people's level of consciousness, all the Christians in the world, many of them were saying that the encounter with the photon belt was going to be the trigger that did the rapture. Now, for most Christians know what the rapture is, but if you're not a Christian, not familiar with the term rapture is where the Christians believe that they will be changed instantaneously. They will be changed from a mortal being into an immortal being, and then they will meet with Jesus Christ and rule with Jesus Christ for the rest of eternity on Earth after he comes back to Earth with his horde of saints and all the people with him. Well, anyway, so I decided that it might be an interesting thing to review the photon belt. And so I went online and did a little bit of research about what the current thinking of the photon belt is, And I found a neat article by Noel Huntley, PhD, and he's on the website www.bibliotechcapitalades.net and university, and he's Spanish, so it's /ESP something. But you can find him if you want to do a search, and you can find similar articles all across the internet. Well, anyway, he gives a little bit of history of the photon belt encounter, and he says that by means of satellite instrumentation, astronomers in 1961 discovered what appeared to be an unusual nebula. Now, a nebula is like a cloud, a gas cloud of stars or gases out in space. And when you have supernovas going off in these nebulas, they shine, and there's all sorts of really beautiful nebulas that can be seen by telescopes that you'll see in astronomy books. Well, anyway, he goes on to say, we normally understand the nebula phenomenon as a vast cloud-like mass of gas or dust. This one, however, appeared to have anomalous properties and was named the Golden Nebula. The public's attention was not drawn to this unusual revelation until much later, presumably when it was realized that this nebula's location was coincident with a projected orbit of our solar system. Around the early 1980s, a radio announcement in the U.S. was made that our solar system was in fact going to collide with an electromagnetic cloud in the not-too-distant future. This incredibly important statement of astronomical and historical significance was expressed in the usual casual and indifferent manner as though of little consequence. And then follow-up data was then suppressed, and another government cover-up was contrived for the typical purpose of exploiting where possible natural events to camouflage the chaos. So that's kind of a typical government reaction to this kind of thing. So the question is, what exactly is this electromagnetic cloud, this Golden Nebula, sometimes referred to as the Radiant Nebula by ETs? Well, what it is a more universal designation. Its more universal designation is photon belt or photon band, consisting of many bands, and any encounter with this belt is recognized by extraterrestrials as of great import. In fact, referred to more enlightened ETs like the Pleiadians as a planetary troubleshooter. And Dr. Noel Huntley has a video on his website showing what that's about. All right, so here's what he goes on to say. The whole universe is held together by means of vortices within vortices of centripetal energy. And I'll be talking more about that when we talk about holograms in the second part of the program today. They're associated electromagnetic fields like whirlpools on water within larger whirlpools. This is the machinery behind Einstein's space-time topology of general relativity. These spiraling energies give rise to natural space-time orbits, satellites around planets, planets around stars, solar systems around other more vortex centers, and so on. Our planet Earth orbits the sun once a year, but our solar system as a whole also traverses an orbit in this section of the galaxy with a period of about 24,000 years. There are many other solar systems in this cyclic motion, just as there are numerous planets orbiting the sun. The Pleiades, which is kind of central to the photon belt in a way, the Pleiades, which is encircled by the photon belt, is about 400 light years from us and is part of the system. And in fact, our solar system orbits the central sun of the Pleiades, and the name of that central sun is Alcyone. The photon belt consists of many photon bands emanating from the center of the galaxy and associated with the spiral arms of the galaxy. Thus, our solar system, and therefore planet Earth, takes some 24,000 years to come back to its same point in this particular orbit. Just picture several star systems with a massive orbit, but now just picture a toroid or donut-shaped cloud cutting across these orbiting star systems. The photon belt is also described as an amoeba-like cloud of particles, but most of its frequencies are invisible. This is the photon belt or photon band. This means our solar system goes through the belt twice each cycle of 24,000 years. The thickness of the photon belt or the photon cloud is such that it technically takes 2,000 years for our solar system to pass through, and therefore there's about 10,000 years between each encounter, and so it kind of goes in and out of this donut-shaped object twice in 24,000 years. Nevertheless, some sources state that the period in the band could be much less, 30 to 40 years, depending on man's resistance to change. And this is difficult to relate to our fixed cycle picture, but in addition, the same source points out that Earth was in trouble from the damage incurred by our civilization and called for the photon belt, a typical emergency call procedure for planets. Now, for anybody that's been paying any attention to our planet Earth, the planet Earth is in the process of dying. The governments have put so much poisons and gases and have poisoned the planet Earth so much that it's becoming very sick and is in the process of dying. All life on the planet will be extinct if this process continues for much longer. We're on a downhill path, as a side, last night, or the night before on Coast to Coast, they had a scientist on that was talking about a new emergency for planet Earth that has not been made public yet, and that is the permafrost in eastern Siberia, Russia. There's a huge area that is melting off and allowing methane gases to escape from underground into the atmosphere. And he said if that goes the way it did 65 million years ago, all life on Earth will become extinct. And he says it's just boiling. The methane gas is just boiling out of the ground through the permafrost, which is melting because of everything that the governments are doing with their HAARP projects and global warming and everything else. And he said if once that methane gas hits the atmosphere is going to warm up to 3 or 4 times its present temperature, and life will not be tenable. It's an extinction event, the planet could be extinct in less than 2 years unless just even that portion of it is stopped. So because of this and the condition that planet Earth is, planet Earth, for people that don't know, is actually a living being. It's a living entity, and it is called on the photon belt as an emergency call, and the photon belt can respond by helping save the planet. So I'll continue the article here. It says, the fact that the call was synchronous with the orbital position merely indicates the higher plans, that the big picture would already have matters organized to happen in that way. This call occurred in 1947 and manifested as a signal which could have been monitored on the AM band, producing a clicking sound. And there was a gentleman by the name of Robert Shapiro who documented a lot of that. So then the article goes on, well, when is this interaction going to occur? Well, scientists around the globe in 1992 predicted that the encounter would occur within months. Other people said it wouldn't happen until after 2010 or 2012, and all these nobody knew exactly when we would encounter the photon belt. Other Pleiadians tell us that our solar system skimmed the belt for a few days in 1987, then contacted it for over a week in the following year, 1988, increasing the degree of entry each year. And then the sun, our sun, went fully in 1998. And they were predicting at the time that it would be after 2012 before the Earth actually fully entered into the photon belt. But the leading edge of our solar system has already entered the photon belt. And that is the belt, the photon belt has an outer aura, which we enter first. And then we are not expected to experience the full-blown effects until after 2012. Well, the article goes on to... hang on a second, I'm getting interrupted here on the computer, okay? The article goes on to say, well, what does the photon belt consist of? What will its effects on life on our planet be? Will it be positive or negative? Also, what is its purpose, if any? The radio announcement used the term electromagnetic to describe the phenomenon. This is the same as photon, which is a particle of light or electromagnetic radiation. So the photon belt is really an immense region of space which is radiating intense electromagnetic radiation throughout the visible spectrum and beyond in the higher frequency invisible light. Even including some X-ray spectra, it is part of a magnetic flow of light throughout the galaxy. Reference has already been made through the media to huge increases an intensity of dangerous radiation entering through holes in the ozone layer in certain regions of our planet. Well, it appears that for mankind on this planet, the photon belt encounter will be essentially a spiritual experience, but this really depends on man. Nevertheless, the real benefits of this phenomenon is from what is actually called the photons. It is linked with the so-called convergences. If we are sufficiently evolved at the time, great advancements will occur in our consciousness as we attune to the higher frequencies. If we are negative, that is, possess too many lower vibrations, the result of selfish actions, we are not expected to survive the frequency incompatibility. And I remember back in the 90s, that was really talked about a lot, especially in the Christian churches. They were telling everybody, you better get saved so you can survive and go through the rapture. And if you're not part of the rapture, you're going to wind up in a horrible, miserable place. So it's the same kind of thinking there. Anyway, have any comments about what I've said so far? Sandy, any comments that you'd like to add at this point? Val, you have any things you'd like to add at this point yet? I see we got some more.
Bob, can you kind of just go over again what the photon belt is in your own words, like what it is and what it means to the Earth? Is it magnetic area in outer space? Is it around the Earth in some way, or the galaxy? How does it work? Where is it?
Well, if you look out in the night sky, you will. If you look up at night, and somewhere around, I would say around 10 o'clock or midnight, in the winter anyway, and look up, at least from where we live in northern Wisconsin, you look up almost overhead, slightly to the south. And you can see the star system Orion. And Orion is very It's a very common constellation that most people are familiar with. And if you look at the three stars in Orion's belt, and you if you follow a straight line from Orion's belt off to the right, you'll some distance away, you'll see a blurry constellation. You'll see a whole group of stars that's like its own constellation. Well, that is the Pleiades. And the Pleiades is a star system that's very well known. It's been written down in history. There's a lot of writings about the constellation Pleiades. Well, what's interesting about the photon belt is centered around the Pleiades star system, and it's like a big donut shape around the Pleiades. And the Pleiades constellation is, according to this gentleman, about 400 light years away from here, from our solar system. Well, I know that back in the 90s when I was dealing with Semyasi and the Pleiadians that came from the Pleiades, they said that where they lived in the Pleiades was 500 light years from Earth, and it took them 7.5 minutes to get here in their advanced technology saucers that they were flying. But the photon belt is centered. It's like a huge donut right around with the center of the donut being the Pleiades star system, and it's a gas cloud. That's a huge gas cloud, and this gas cloud is something. Well, it's a huge cloud, thousands of miles across, and because this gas cloud is so big, and we are so close to it, we actually pass through that photon belt or photon cloud, and we do that twice every 24,000 years. So I don't know. Does that help answer your question, Val?
Yeah, that helps a little bit. Henry has some information too he'd like to share. No, just a comment. It was interesting about the Maoris and stuff.
Oh yeah. Yeah, in New Zealand, the Maori people, the main stars they talk about are the seven stars in the sky. I can't remember their name for it right now, but they celebrate it some time of the year. So maybe it's the same thing.
Well, I guess this has been going on for a long time, you know, and so I'm sure that a lot of the older civilizations, the more advanced ones, knew about the photon belt. Well, let me continue this article. what's going to happen here? It says in this article, it appears that for mankind on this planet, the photon belt encounter will be essentially a spiritual experience. But it really depends on man. If you have a high positive energy, it's going to be good for you. If you have very low spiritual vibrations, you're very selfish, you might have a problem with the photon belt. It says, the stellar activations have already begun and will continue. In this article it says from 2012 to 2017, but I think that time is off just a little bit because I think we're just on the verge of it right now. We're just entering it. And it says here, the stellar activation occurs when of the Pleiades, which the star Alcyone, Sirius is involved, Arcturus is involved, Orion, of course, is right next to the Pleiades, not too far away, and Andromeda. the frequency bands then merge and pass through Earth. And if Earth is out of balance within itself due to abuse from invader ETs, i.e. the Illuminati, and Earthman's behavior, the higher frequencies in this article, according to this, will cause an Armageddon. Now, that's just one person's opinion. To understand the alignment, one could think of circles within circles, or cycles within cycles, turning at different rates to which are attached magnets. Clearly, periodically, they could line up, forming one long and powerful magnet. This would act like a powerful current. It is called the holographic beam, since it contains the fundamental energy of these systems. And when I talk about holograms in the part two of today's talk, I'll go into some of this stuff, the holographic universe that we're living in. Excuse me. It says, after the convergence, this holographic beam carries the remains of photon activity. And when the Earth is in alignment, it merges with higher dimensional parallel Earth, Terra. And that's one I'm not really familiar with, but you guys probably know about Terra. During this process, the particles and antiparticles of these planets and their anti-parallel planets are unified in certain specific ways. When these particles and antiparticles come together, they create intense photonic activity, which we know as the photon belt. It is continually renewed each cycle as the holographic beam passes out through Alcyon, leaving the band around the star. As implied, there will be a natural spiritual selection. In the initial stages of photon belt encounter, only the sensitive will detect anything strange. But when we fully enter, even the most hardened individuals will receive the full effects. Both great illumination of consciousness will occur and great resistance to new ideas. This is a period of awakening, essentially due to the ascension cycle and planetary alignment. What proportion of effects are directly due to the belt is difficult to say. Nevertheless, this phenomenon of both the photon belt plus stellar activity will reduce the veil, stopping us from seeing who we are. It will remove some of the barriers around the cells and the DNA, making them more reactive and responsive to new energies. And in fact, the DNA will attempt to respond to the changing frequencies, increasing its capacity. Now, I've heard people say, this is not in the article, but I've heard people say that when we go into the photon belt, our DNA will be changed from 2 strands to 12 strands. And that's a fantastic change. Anyway, he goes on to say that psychological characteristics of entering the belt are the effect of uprooting hidden, secret, or withheld material, bringing it to the surface for transmutation. This means psychological and physical disease patterns will be forced to the surface, that is, the conscious mind. This will give tremendous opportunity to make advancements, but also where there is too much to handle, it will cause illness, depression, disease, and death. More advanced viewpoints see the photon band as being a consciousness, which essentially has a personality for change and action. It presents opportunities for change on a planet by adding new energies. It increases the flow of energy of the magnetic grids of Earth, attracting new ideas and energies. People will feel the need to transform, but those who consider this physical reality their only expression will dwindle into greater fixations, blocks, and negativity. So it even says, nevertheless, it aids eradication of a species' self-destructive tendencies, which might mean wiping out the civilization. It says even the most dense person will be accelerated into a higher state of consciousness, causing possible havoc in their mind and body if they are not prepared. And it goes on to say that talks about channeled information, which I won't really go into. Other information from the source has been given about the effect on animals. They will forage more widely and attempt to give birth more often to maximize their species. They will be drawn to build up areas. In some cases, this will be old territory for them, but they will feel the need to be closer to humans and even for the wild animals. And it says the effects on the Earth's body are expected to be quite dramatic. The photon belt enables the planet to repair herself. She will, for example, protect her oil. Too much is being drawn off by man and cannot all be replaced. Not dissimilar to drawing off a man's cerebral spinal fluid. Mother Earth will harden the crust under the surface and pull in oil, gases, coal, and ores deeper into the center, shifting harmlessly also benevolent races in the protected regions. The photon belt will not apparently leave until humans utilize surface resources only, including water. It says, scientists will find that subatomic particles will become more evident and easier to detect. Electricity will be reduced and become less available in the next 50 years. This represents an energy depletion of the planet. Earth is taking on a new energy, and scientists must find a new ways of working with it. So, scientists will be paying more attention to how love affects life and its chemistry. New diseases will rise and abnormal heart rhythms for the descending group, but expansion of the heart for the ascending group. And there's going to be a number of other spectacular effects that this article goes on to talk about. But anyway, that's the gist of what I wanted to talk about on the photon belt, just kind of like an introduction to the photon belt, what it's about. And, you know, for anybody that's never heard of the photon belt, if anybody would like to share any ideas that they have about the photon belt, please speak up and add what you can.
Well, just, you know, I'm a naturalist, so I'm just looking at it from the Native American viewpoint. Just a little article, it says that, as so is often the case, things that scientists are just now proving have been known by the ancients for time immemorial. They didn't need proof. They had an inner knowing of what was right and true. Some Native American tribes teach there is one star in the heavens for each human on Earth, and that is their soul twin. Most ancient cultures around the world have legends about the major star clusters. They teach their descendants of immigrants from star nations, particularly the Pleiades. Native American legends denote the Pleiades as a sacred place in the heavens. Lakota legend says they originated from the Pleiades, and that after death, the soul returns to its home in the Pleiades. And while they are on Earth, they were given the task by the Pleiades to tend and care for Mother Earth. Native American tribes have done a very good job of that tending. The rest of us have not. So no matter what we talk about, we have to deal with what's going on here with the environment, and indigenous type of peoples have that connection, and all this technology and knowledge that we're getting, I'm not sure where it goes exactly, but you know, they had this knowledge too, but they, at the same time, they made sense of it and didn't get carried away with it and actually, you know, help and supported Mother Earth and the environment. So that was kind of interesting that they have this connection and we're conditioned not to. So thanks, Bob.
Anybody else like to add anything? Sandy, you want to add anything? No, Sandy doesn't want to add anything. I could say one thing about the Pleiadians. that my friend that was working and introduced me to the existence of the Pleiadians, and they did a flyby and caused my car to quit on the highway. I've told that story before. And Semyonovsky dated Alexander Graham Bell's grandson for about 10 years before she had to leave our solar system and go back onto other projects. And our friend with the CIA said that there's actually two groups of Pleiadians that were here. There was Semyonovsky's group, who were very advanced. They're like 3,000, technology-wise, if you can even quantify it, was said to have been 3,000 years ahead of us, and they were very benevolent beings. They were actually doing everything in their power to help us. They can't break the laws of the universe. They have to be asked for help. But the Semyonovsky's group of the Pleiadians are the ones that were the primary cause for the ending of the Cold War. They're the ones that went in and shut down all the atomic missile bases where they would launch atomic missiles. They'd hover over the bases and shut down their electronic circuits so the missiles could not be launched. And they disabled a lot of the military aircraft that were carrying nuclear bombs on board, and they disabled the circuit so they could not launch or drop the bombs on anybody. That was one group of Pleiadians that I really feel an affinity for. And then there was another group of Pleiadians that were probably not as benign. They were actually working with the reptilians and the tall whites, and they were actually developing technologies to control the Earth. And their technology was about 300 years advanced of what we have on Earth, instead of 3,000 years advanced. And they were part of the problem on this planet, along with the reptilians and some of the other people that we have to deal with here. So when you talk about the Pleiadians, they do have more than one group from their star cluster. So I just wanted to point that out. So the next topic I would like to talk about is holograms. My first introduction to holograms was in 1971. I was a young man, and I was in a Navy ROTC scholarship program. And every summer between your college years, you have to go on what they call a summer cruise. And I was taken to a summer cruise out of San Diego, California. And I during this cruise, we were invited to, not invited, we were ordered to go down to Point Loma, which was an advanced Navy research center where they were doing advanced research on all sorts of different projects. And it was also a submarine base where they were working with state-of-the-art submarines and all sorts of stuff like that. But we were taken into a room, and we met one of their top physicists who introduced us to lasers. And at the time, they were playing around with different kinds of lasers, and the one that they demonstrated was a red laser, which which is formed by shooting high-intensity light through a ruby, and that's why it gets its red color. And one of the interesting things about the laser at that time is they were able to measure distances. Even in 1971, they could use a laser light to measure distances, and they had a digital readout, and they had a projector, and they put the readout of the distance, so they would shine this laser light across a room, and the reading up above on the overhead that we could watch was actually showing the distance from the laser light to the object that they were shining the laser light on. And the guy was demonstrating how accurate it was. He put his hand on top of the laser machine, and the warmth of his hand warmed the metal of the machinery that was holding the laser light, and it changed the distance from the laser to the object by something like 2 or 3 ten-thousandths of an inch, and that was measured by the laser light. That's how precise the laser light could measure distances. And also they had a laser weapon that they didn't have it as a weapon, but they took a piece of metal, like a, they had a steel razor blade, like, you know, the old shavers have those one-sided razor blades, and they put that in front of the beam. And this laser beam that they had was maybe a quarter-inch diameter. And they had the laser light off, and they said, well, this laser will shoot through objects. And they placed this razor blade in front of the laser light and held it in position, and then they turned on the laser for about a tenth of a second, and it burned a beautiful round hole right through that steel razor blade, you know, showing us how the power of the laser worked. But perhaps one of the most interesting things was when they showed us a hologram. They were working with holographic technologies, and they were on the leading edge of holographic technologies at the time. And remember, this is 1971. This was, you know, like a long time ago, almost 40 years ago, 50 years ago. And what they did is they took a hologram of a naval battleship, and they displayed the hologram by shining a light into a spherical chamber, and what you could see was, and there was, once again, they were using a red laser, you would see this battleship, and what really kind of awed me was the fact that you could, it was like it was chest high where they had this display, and you could stand so that you're looking right down on top of the deck of this battleship, and you, that's all you could see. And if you stood in front of it, you could see everything in the front. You could see the bridge where the captain, you know, rode and everything. And you could see the anchors hanging off each side of the bow. You could see them. But if you walked to the back of the ship, you couldn't see any of the stuff in the front. You could only see the stuff from the back. And if you got down and looked up underneath the hull of the ship, all you could see is like the screws and the rudder and the bottom of the hull, but you couldn't see anything on top of the deck. It was a true three-dimensional picture. It was like somebody built a model of the ship and displayed it in the case. I mean, it was real 3D dimensionality. It was the real deal, you know. And so that was my introduction to what a hologram looked like. Another interesting experience that I became familiar with was I was discussing holograms with a friend of mine down in the Chicago area, and this was around 1990, 91, somewhere in that area. And he said he and his wife had just been over in Ohio, and they had gone out to a real fancy restaurant, a real expensive steak restaurant. And when they walked in, they found into the restaurant, they found that as they walked in, they had a huge dance floor, a wooden dance floor, in the middle of the restaurant, and all the tables where the patrons would eat were in booths all the way around the outside of where this dance floor was. And as they walked in, they were playing music, something, and they had a bunch of ballroom dancers dancing up a storm with their fancy dresses on, and they were swinging and spinning just like, you know, like you would expect to see at you know, some dance, you know, a ballroom dance, you know, with the crystal chandeliers and everything. And these people were just dancing up a storm and having a merry old time. The music was going strong, and the hostess, you know, took them to their seats off to the side of the dance floor, and they had to walk around the edge of the dance floor. And as these people were dancing and spinning around, my friend said he had to duck a couple of times because they came so close. He actually had to sidestep to keep from getting hit by them because he didn't want to interrupt their dancing. And when he finally got to his table and sat down, when the waitress came to wait on him, you know, he asked the waitress, well, where did you find all these people to come in and dance? I mean, this is really unusual, having ballroom dancing in a steak restaurant like this. And the waitress said, well, sir, they're not real. And my friend said, what do you mean they're not real? They're a hologram. They're not real. It's just they look real, and you can't tell them from being real, but they're holograms. And she said, next time they get near you, stick your hand out. And he did, and his hand went right through him. So that was my next introduction to holographic technology. So it had come a long way since 1971. And now if you go online and do a little bit of research about holograms, you'll see that a lot of companies now will have showroom displays of very expensive equipment that is not real. You know, it'll be on display just for the public to view, but it's a hologram. And one example is like a $150,000 high-speed racing motorcycle will be displayed on a showroom floor. You know, the bike will be about 8 feet long and have all its gadgets and fancy tires and everything and all its fancy colors, but it's a hologram. It looks as solid as could possibly be, but it's just a hologram. You can walk over to it and put your hand right through it. It's just not real. Now, what brought me up to even discussing holograms was I broke down and what brought my attention to all this was I started reading David Icke's, one of his latest books that was copyrighted in 2013, and it's called The Perception Deception, and that's by David Icke, and the book is over 800 pages long, maybe 900 pages long, and I've only read the first 100 pages of it, and he started talking about these holograms, so I thought, well, gee, I wanted to share that with everybody. Now, in case you don't know what a hologram is or how they do a hologram, a basic hologram is created by using a laser light and a camera and a couple mirrors. And what you do is you have a typical camera and, you know, a photographic plate, and you take a laser light of whatever kind of laser light that you have, whether it be a white laser light or red or any other color, whatever technology you're using. And what you do is you take the light out of the projector. It shoots a laser, shoots a straight line, and it's a high-intensity light, and you shine it through a mirror. And the mirror that you shine it through is designed so that it's not 100% reflective. It's only 50% reflective. And as you shine the laser light through a mirror, this mirror, half of the light goes through and half of it doesn't. And you take the part that is reflected by the mirror, you take half of it and take the pure, what's called the pure basic signal, and you shine that directly into the camera that's photographing this. And the other half of the laser beam, you use mirrors to bounce around and reflect. You have the light shine onto the object that you're trying to take a photograph of. And so what happens is when you take the actual photo shot, you have what's called an interference pattern. You have the direct laser light going into the camera, plus you have the light reflected off the object that you're trying to make a hologram out of, and both signals enter into the camera, and you snap the picture, and you have you develop yourself a holographic, what's called a holographic plate, and that's the basic information. Now, in order to see a hologram or display a hologram, you have to take the developed plate and shine a laser light through that holographic plate. And when you shine a laser light through that holographic plate, it creates a display of the original object in three dimensions. Now, that is the basic hologram. Well, today, the technology is so advanced that not only can you take a single picture of an object, you can actually have moving pictures. Now, one of the most recent public examples of a fantastic holographic image took place during the destruction of the World Trade Center in New York City. Two aircraft were flown into the buildings, and they said it was the government, of course, said it was airliners full of passengers that were fighting the hijackers right up to the point of impact where these two airliners crashed into the World Trade Centers. But the truth of the matter is those were not aircraft. What was seen crashing into the World Trade Center was really a hologram of an aircraft. And that's how advanced the technology is. And how do we know it was a hologram instead of a real airplane? Because before it was removed from the media, the guys who were running the holographic projector didn't control the projection properly, and one of the aircraft flew into the building, and something like 20 feet of the right wing came out the far side of the building undamaged. Well, that's impossible for a real airplane to go through and have a wing, 20 feet of the outboard wing go through all that concrete and brick and steel beams and come out untouched on the far side of the building. Just absolutely impossible. So that is how we know that those were holographic projections. Of course, as soon as people started pointing that out, the government and all the media did everything they could to go back on all the websites and edit out that portion of the video that showed that part. They just wanted to show the impact and then stop the projection at that point in time. All right, so the reason I've brought all this up about the holograms, as I want to point out, as David Icke has pointed out, everything that we see in creation, the physical life in this cause-effect creation is a hologram. Every person on this planet, every being, everything that we see, our bodies are nothing but holograms, just kind of like in the movie The Matrix, we're holograms. And we experience life. What we experience by life has a lot to do with how we decode the holographic information that is presented to us. And I'd like to give a couple examples. David Icke had a couple, and I'd like to show that a holographic universe, there's even a book written called The Holographic Universe, talks about how everything ever made is a hologram. And there's some really interesting defining characteristics of a hologram, which maybe some of you are aware of, and that is that every part of a hologram contains a part of the whole. I don't know, anybody ever heard that? Anybody listening ever heard that? So if you have, would you speak up and let me know that you've heard that expression before?
No.
Nobody?
I haven't.
Okay, well, it goes it goes to prove the point that there is no time and there is no space. There is no such thing as time and space. It's all illusion. And these holograms provide the source of the illusion, and it's how we experience time and space is how we take that holographic information and decode it. We decode it into time and space. Now, let me give you an example of how time and space are an illusion. You know, my grandfather used to have an 8-millimeter camera. I don't know if you guys have ever dealt with an 8-millimeter camera. He used to have a little camera. He'd go around, he'd take pictures of the northern woods and, you know, us fishing off the dock and all that kind of stuff. And he'd get the film developed, and the film was maybe, 3/8 of an inch wide, you know, just over a quarter to 3/8 of an inch wide, and it had little holes along the side, and it had a whole bunch of frames. You ever see an 8-millimeter film before? Well, you can take this film, this movie film, and you can hold it up, and you can look at all the individual images on that film, and you can see that everything is there. There's no space and time. All the information contained in reality is on that film. It's all there. The past and the future, it's all there. You're holding it in your hand. Well, where does time and space come from? Well, when you take that film and run it through a projector, it goes click, 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 click. It runs one frame at a time for a very short period of time. It'll run a frame. It'll close the camera. The light will be stopped. It'll advance to the next frame. It'll show the next frame. It'll stop, move to the next frame, and it'll go through the series of frames, and it gives the illusion that there's motion taking place. But there is no motion. It's all an illusion. So anytime you have motion, there you have time. Time is an illusion. And if you take that a step forward, let's say you take a DVD and put a movie in your DVD player and turn on your TV and start watching a movie. And let's just take The Love Boat for an example. Let's say you're watching The Love Boat, which is an old TV show, and it's an ocean liner on the Atlantic Ocean, and you're watching this ship on your flat screen TV, and is there an ocean liner in your living room? Now get real with me here. You know, bear with me for a second. Is there an ocean liner inside your living room? Probably not. How about the Pacific or the Atlantic Ocean? Is the Atlantic Ocean inside your living room? Probably not. How about the buildings of downtown Miami or Fort Lauderdale where they sailed their love boat from? Any guesses? You have any tall skyscrapers in your living room? Probably not. Well, we watch TV, and we see all these things, and we think that there's space and time, but it's just an illusion. Well, I went over a little bit today. We still have like half an hour, but I'll start wrapping it up a little bit if I can. You guys mind if I go over a little bit? Time-wise?
Fine.
Okay, well, anyway, so it says, David Icke words it really well. He says, as with space, so with time. There is no such thing as time except the encoded information, the way you encode it. There is only the eternal now. And David Icke goes on and said, by that, I do not mean the now as another word for the present. That's not what now means. Now, present in the sense of the present, the past, present, future. David Icke says, I mean the now in which the past, present, and future are all the same experience. All these experiences that we go through are all happening now. It's our method of decoding it that makes it seem as if there's a flow of time or there's space. Now, we can look at a movie and say, okay, sure, I understand that with a movie. I know that when I turn off my flat screen TV, there's just a blank screen. I know there's a bunch of pixels in there that show the different colors, and they can shine electrons on it, and they can make it look like a three-dimensional picture. I know all that. But in the world that we live in, it functions exactly the same way. There is absolutely no difference between what we see on TV and a movie than what we experience in our daily living life. We are interpreting a holographic universe, and what we see is the way we decode it, using primarily our five senses to decode it. And what's interesting about that is seeing is decoding. Whenever we, and our mind, 80% of what we see is what our mind really picks up on, our brain really picks up on, 80%. Now, let me share another thing that's really, really interesting here. The realization that the body is a hologram, like everything else in this reality, opens the door to explanations about so many mysteries that baffle mainstream science, including phenomena that are dismissed and refuted by the scientific establishments. One of the amazing characteristics of holograms is that every part of a hologram is a smaller version of the whole. Put another way, if you cut a holographic waveform print into four pieces and point the laser at each one, you will not see four quarter segments of the holographic image. You will see four quarter-sized versions of the entire hologram. Clarity may be lost as the hologram is reduced in this way, but it still represents the information of the entire hologram. Each part of a hologram is a smaller version of the whole. So like if you have a regular photograph, let's say you take a 35 millimeter photograph, black and white or color photograph of something, and cut it up into four pieces, and let's say you take a picture of a person standing there, the bottom left piece of the picture is going to show the person's, if they're facing you, they're going to show their right foot and right leg. The right piece is going to show their left leg, and the top might show their arms and head or shoulders or whatever. It actually breaks the picture up into pieces. But in a hologram, every piece of information of the entire hologram is represented in every tiny piece of a hologram. So whenever you take a hologram and cut it into finer pieces, each small piece contains all the information of the original hologram. Now, what's interesting about this for people that might be into holistic healing and that sort of thing, it's this principle explains why reflexology, acupuncture, and other forms of alternative healing can find areas in different parts of the body, the hand, ear, foot, whatever, that affects different organs and processes of the whole body. It has to be like this because the body is a hologram. Now, what that means is like for example, you ever wonder why an acupuncture person will stick needles in somebody's leg to heal their liver? What's their leg got to do with their liver? Why aren't they sticking the needles, right in their side where their liver is and using 4-inch needles to reach right into the liver? Well, in acupuncture, the ancient Chinese knew all these principles of holographic information, but a lot of these healers that do acupuncture do not understand the principle that when you stick a needle into somebody's leg, you're actually contacting the part of the internal organ in that part of their leg that contains the information about the internal organs, and that's how acupuncture is able to function. And there's kind of a semi-proof that we are holographic individuals. Now, there's any questions or comments about that information? Well, I have another interesting comment about the holographic projector. How does this take place? How is holographic projection done? I mean, how do they do it? I mean, where's the projector? You know, if we're living in a holographic universe, where's the projector, and how are we able to see this hologram and decode it? Anybody have any ideas on how that's possible? You know,
well, satellites
guys...
in space that help project these images through white lasers, I understand. One thing.
Well, that is very true. That when they did the 9/11 thing and they probably did use projectors from space to create those holograms. And you've probably all heard of Project Blue Book, which has been talked about for years, where the government's going to use holographic projectors to simulate the returning of Christ and all his UFOs coming to planet Earth. You know, that's supposed to be the great illusion showing that Jesus Christ is returning to Earth and is going to wipe out all the bad guys and all that stuff. Well, that's... You know, you probably heard that story. Well, that would be done by a holographic projector, just like they used in 9/11. But my question is, how in the world is our entire life? I mean, everything that we live. I mean, we can have these holographic projectors within our reality, in our cause effect reality. But how in the world does our cause and effect matrix world get produced? Where does that come from? How is that being done? Now, any thoughts on that? I mean, what is the original of the original? What, you know, we're living in a holographic universe. Where is the projectors for that? Any ideas?
Well, I would say agreement has a lot to do with it. You start with agreement, and then people add on to it. The controllers add on their 2 cents worth, you know, with their technology and all that. But I mean, if you don't agree to what you see, you know, you see it, but it really doesn't exist in true reality. So the true reality we call the is, or this all isness, true universes. I mean, it's an isness. It's not a projection of any sort. And once you agree to that, once you align yourself with that, you see things for what they really are and not just an illusion. It's one view.
Well, the question is, how does this, I mean, we do know that we're living in a cause-effect created universe, right? It obviously is created, right?
Yes.
I mean, we all agree to the fact that we're living in a created universe. Well, my... Yes? Well...
Affirmative.
Okay, now, I would submit... Now, I don't have any basis for knowing this, but I would think... Now see what you think of this idea. What would you think if sound, you know, we've often heard of the expression the sound and light. what would you think of the idea that the sound from the all is that is projected into our cause effect creation is the informational image? Like, now, in order to have a holographic expression or presentation, you need an information plate and you need a laser light to shine through it. What do you think of the concept that the sound is the carrier of the information and the light from the all is the laser light that activates the sound to make the presentation of our holographic created universe?
It's a nice idea, and the brain is like a transformer, you know, and the spinal cord and all the functions of the body kind of like are projectors in themselves as well.
Well, actually, the brain is the decoder. It's the brain that decodes the information so that we can actually recognize the projection of the holograms. Now, one thing that I thought was very interesting, years ago, I belonged to the the Society of Unified Science, and we were trying to find out where everything came from. And one of the things that we studied, the guy who started the club wrote a book called Nothing But Motion. And we were able to show the background universal frequency for the universe. The background universal frequency, at the last meeting I attended, somewhere around 1992 or 1994, I can't remember exactly, but it was on the order of something like 37 megahertz or 37 trillion cycles per second. And what we were able to show was that every second there was a photon emitted into what we would call reality or into existence. The frequency of the photon generation, wherever it might be, was, well, let's just go with 37 trillion a second. And I want to talk about an article in Wonderpedia magazine. Now, David Icke brings this up. I got to give him credit for bringing this out. He says that, I brought this, and it's in his book. He says, every second, 11 million sensations crackle along the pathways in the body on their way to a highly complex structure. The brain, the human brain, is confronted with an alarming array of images, sounds, and smells, which it rigorously filters down until it is left with a manageable list of around 40. Thus, 40 sensations per second make up what we perceive as reality. I mean, so let's just say out of those 37 trillion, or let's say it's 37, you know, billion, photons being activated every second, when the human brain is sensing, I mean, they can do this in a laboratory. They can actually measure that the body is exposed to 11 million sensations going into our brain every second. Out of the 11 million sensations of this holographic projection, we only get 40 of them. The brain narrows it down and says it only makes sense out of 40 of the impressions. So David Icke brings up the point. He says, well, how can people possibly think they know what's going on when there's 11 million sensations that are giving us information and our brain only picks up 40 of them? That's less than 5 thousandths of 1% of what actually exists in the universe. And so what happens is our mind fills in the missing blanks. And so here we are, we're living in a holographic universe. We have all this holographic information being thrown at us, and our brains are deciphering only 40 of these sensory impressions every second, which is minuscule. Well, what's the problem? Since I'm running out of time, I'm gonna kind of make a long story short. What is the problem with what's going on in the world today? Well, since we live in a holographic universe and we're decoding only 40 impressions a second, and who knows what we do with that? If all we were getting was the regular impressions, you know, life would be fine. I mean, we could get by, right? Well, anyway, here is something that I think is extremely important for everybody to know, and that is this. Has anybody ever heard of the Gnostic Christians that lived in the first few centuries AD, and the 200 or 300 AD? Anybody hear of the Gnostic Christians? You've probably heard about them as being the Essenes and that sort of group of people, and they had a belief system that was slightly different from the biblical teachings. You know, anybody heard about the Gnostic Christians?
Sure, I knew a bishop. She was living in Northern California. She practiced that, and you know, direct experience rather than belief based. It's very interesting.
Well, here's what I found interesting from David Icke's book, and I was totally unaware of this. I've heard about the Gnostic Christians ever since I picked up my first Bible back around 1970 or 1970, somewhere around in there. But the thing I was not aware of was the Gnostic pagans. It says, David Icke points out that a local peasant at Nag Hammadi in Egypt, a town on the banks of the River Nile some 77 miles from Luxor, he had found a sealed jar, and a papyrus was used to preserve it. And he found what was called we were deceived into believing that the only thing that was out there were the Christian Gnostics, but he found works of the pagan Gnostics, not the later Christian Gnostics. And the jar this guy found contained 13 codices and more than 50 texts, which have given us far greater insight of what the Gnostics knew and believed when this stuff was translated. Now, guess what they talked about? They talked about the Archons. And the Archons were a group of reptilians and gray aliens whose only function in life was to distort the holographic projection. And what they did is they would manipulate the senses and affect the direct perception of reality so that people would not get a clear picture of what life is really supposed to be out there. They were in the business of distorting it. And so, like the grays that were found on the Roswell crash, and the reptilians, and right in these writings, it talks about how the Demiurge were the ones who were ruling over the Archons, and the Archons were the ones that were part of like the Hebrew Saturn god El, and his biblical Elohim, and the Gnostic Lord Archon, the Archons, they're all the same thing under a different name. And what's interesting is they are capable of of really altering reality. And what's an interesting characteristic that I think is very interesting about living in a holographic environment is you can be, your perceptions can be so altered, your reality can be so altered, just completely twisted out of what life really is, and you don't even realize it. And now, and a great example that David Icke gave was when this hypnotist, there was a hypnotist that had a man and his sister were sitting in the audience, and he brought him up in front of the audience, and he sat the guy down in the chair, and he had his sister stand directly in front of him, and kind of blocking his view, like standing a foot away from him as he sat in a chair, blocking his view so he could not see anything behind him. And then he hypnotized the guy. He says, "Well, I am hypnotizing you that your sister does not exist. She is not there." And the whole audience is watching this thing, and the guy's sister is standing right in front of him, a foot away, blocking his view. And while this is taking place, another person comes up and does a bunch of things behind his sister's back, out of view from the guy sitting in the chair. I mean, they fold cards and they pour water and they do a bunch of different tricks and things. And the guy, the hypnotist asks the guy, well, tell me what this guy is doing. And he described perfectly exactly everything that the guy was doing behind his sister's back. Well, how could he see? I mean, how is it possible that he could see what was going on? Even if he was hypnotized, how could he see what was going on behind his sister's back when she was blocking his view? Well, this is a characteristic of the holographic universe. Holographic universe is based on perception, and objects do not block the reality because every part of the whole thing is represented by a small part. So that's why he was able to see what was going on behind his sister's back. And now enter the archons. The archons come in, and what they do is they do the same thing as the hypnotist. They are changing everybody's perception into something completely different from what is really taking place on this planet. They are doing all these things that people have no clue. Just like this guy that was being hypnotized, he had no clue that his sister was right in front of him, because his reality was altered, his perception of reality was altered by the hypnotist. Now, any comments on that from anybody?
Well, part of that's where your attention is. I tell this story often where I was in tracking school, and we came in this building every day. It was the third day we came in. Teacher was up there on the blackboard, and he said, "Do you notice anything different?" And people looked around. No, nothing different. And then he said, "Okay, everybody come out." And people were up in the ceiling, down under a bench, around the corner. I mean, in plain sight. But we were so used to coming in with our routine, we didn't look. You know, we stopped looking around because it was familiar. So this is just an example of attention too. There's ways to look at this. And now that's one thing, like where you put your attention during the day. You can see something but not see it. Every day you walk by a lamppost, I mean, you see it, but you don't. It doesn't register in your brain. So that's kind of a self-hypnosis in a way, or other people can manipulate that so that they can control you through it. So it is an interesting subject. There's a lot of viewpoints you can gain from it.
Yeah, and that's an excellent point. And the interesting thing about that, though, is that is an example of some people not paying attention to something that's right in front of their face. The thing about the hypnotist is being able to see something, you know, instead of not seeing something that's in front of your face, the hypnotist story is seeing something that being able to see something that's not readily available to see. It's just like kind of the opposite. Now, here's a comment by Michael Elner, and he says that the archons invert everything. And he says, just look at us. Everything is backwards in society today. He says, everything is backwards. Everything is upside down. Doctors destroy health. You know, did you know that doctors manage to kill 140,000 people every year on the operating table? Lawyers destroy justice. I can't tell you of all the stories where I've talked to, one gentleman I talked to down in southern Wisconsin said he used to work for he was an accountant, a top accountant for one of those major corporations. And every time that they would have a big to-do come up in court, they would just talk to the judge and say, meet us in Florida. And he would actually get on the airplane. They'd take a corporate jet down to Fort Lauderdale or Miami or someplace, and they would have suitcases full of cash money, and they would invite the judge over, and they would give the judge suitcases, like $2 million of cash at a time, to rule in the corporation's favor. Another example that Michael Elner talks about, he says, psychiatrists destroy minds. Instead of helping people, psychiatrists destroy minds. Scientists destroy truth. And major media destroys information. Instead of telling you the truth, they twist it around and tell you exactly the opposite of what happened. And religions destroy spirituality. You know, you'd think that religions would help spirituality. All they are is dumbed down, you know, spirit-free organizations. It's kind of like a boys' club. It doesn't do anything for you spiritually. They actually destroy spirituality. And Michael Elner also says governments destroy freedom. Instead of having a government that creates freedom from everybody, they destroy freedom. And that's what these archons do. And the way they're able, the reason they're able to do that is because we live in our created cause and effect universe is holographic in design. And because it's holographic, they are able to alter and distort reality through affecting our perceptions of everything. Well, I think we've just about run out of time. I've gone way over, and I thank everybody for listening. And I'd like to end the show by everybody doing a new you together, and then we'll end the show. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and we'll do a new you. Okay, on the count of three. One, two, three. New you. Well, thank you, everybody, for participating, and we'll talk to you next time. Goodbye.